Welcome, everyone, to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Justin, your host, and I'm joined today by Keetown from the Ministry of Nodes to discuss Bitcoin privacy. Today's episode is sponsored by hardblock.com.au, Australia's first and oldest Bitcoin-only exchange. Hardblock aims to help their users become self-sovereign Bitcoiners and to save in hard money. All right, Keetown, welcome. Thanks for being here, and how's it going?
Good, thanks, mate. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
No problem at all. For anyone listening at the moment, they probably know exactly who you are. I've been listening to you for a while, at least a few years now. However, this will be out there on the internet, which means that in the fullness of time, when the Bitcoin price pumps again and a bunch of new people start coming in looking for content, they will find their way to this episode at some stage. So with that in mind, could you just introduce yourself briefly, like your own sort of personal intro into Bitcoin, as well as what you're doing with the Ministry of Nodes?
Yep. So my name's Keetown, and I am the co-founder of Ministry of Nodes, and we produce educational content to help people do three things, basically. One, hold their own keys, which is a really important mantra in the Bitcoin space. Number two, run their own Bitcoin nodes. And number three, follow best privacy practices when it comes to Bitcoin. That's the type of content that we sort of focus on, particularly on YouTube. And I've been doing that for about 2 or 3 years now. But my journey personally started off with my co-founder, Stefan Lavera, who is also another prominent podcaster in the space. And we basically, he gave me the white paper, and he sort of shielded me the Bitcoin concept, and I fell in love with it instantly. And so that's kind of, where my rabbit hole journey started, through Stefan. And then I've just been going down various different rabbit holes ever since. And so, yeah, here I am.
It sounds like you're one of the smart ones that saw the white paper, and you fell in love instantly. Like, you got it instantly. I didn't. It took me almost about 2 years of hearing about Bitcoin to be like, all right, maybe I'll give this thing a better look.
So what got it for me was the fact that it's not spelt out directly in the white paper, but if you think of it like torrenting movies and torrenting TV shows and those sorts of things, it's basically a torrent for money. And torrenting, they were never able to shut down. And so now, if we just take that same concept of, wait, what, we're torrenting money now? That's when I just went, yeah, this is going to win. This is going to win.
It's such a great example, isn't it? Literally just this morning, I put out a podcast episode with Jeremy from Hardblock, just very basically around nodes for beginners, just concepts. And that's one of the examples that I use to explain a distributed network, is that most people will understand something like torrenting and how you can't take down a file that's distributed across thousands, tens of thousands, millions of computers. And sometimes people don't even have the whole file, they just have parts of it. And that's exactly what the blockchain ledger is. Bitcoin's ledger is on all these different devices, being sort of synced constantly and kind of kept to consensus constantly, which means you can't shut that down unless you try to shut down the entirety of the internet or all of those nodes at once, which is just an infeasible thing that comes with a lot of other problems. And yeah, I think it's a great example just to drive home like what Bitcoin is, with an example that people are normally a bit familiar with if they've been online for long enough. Everyone's torrented a bit here and there.
That's right.
So I just wanted to clarify for people as well. We're going to talk about Bitcoin privacy today. There's a few different tangents with that, or pathways with that. But if any of this is confusing or you want more hand-holding, this is one of the things that the Ministry of Nodes does. So you could reach out to Keetown afterwards to get some extra information, to like set up a one-on-one consulting session or something along those lines. Look, there's other documentation or guides that I'll post as well. So you've got a few different avenues, but it's just good to sort of spruik that, I guess. Anything that we talk about today, if you want more information, I think Keetown's your guy for it.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks.
So I wanted to maybe just start with a very broad definition of privacy, because I think sometimes even this gets get confused, I think, in terms of like a secret versus something that's private. So just to say it really basically, privacy is just the ability to selectively reveal yourself to the public. So that means that if you're a public figure, you can still have privacy. Especially if you have made the decision to become a public figure and share certain things. Privacy doesn't mean that you're a criminal or that you have something to hide. Privacy is just, again, your ability to selectively reveal yourself to the world. Privacy, I think, is something that everyone should keep in mind, because generally speaking, once you need it, it's a luxury that you can't afford. It might be a bit too late at that point. And so with Bitcoin and privacy, I'm just curious, like what's, when people ask you, you know, is Bitcoin private? Or if they have that misconception that Bitcoin is private, like what would you tell them?
So in a nutshell, if you were to ask me, is Bitcoin private by default, I would probably say, if I was to give you one word, no. There are certain things and certain heuristics and certain things that we give away without, you know, that selective revealing. We do it just because, you know, we don't know better, or it's just the default thing to do. So unfortunately, Bitcoin, when it comes to Bitcoin privacy, it's not something that's private by default, but I think it's something that you should be looking into. And the reason that I think you should be looking into it is because you've got to think about Bitcoin as a public ledger, right? You are, perform or transact on the Bitcoin network, you are actually putting a permanent record onto the computers of everyone, of these, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of nodes and growing. So basically, this is a permanent record. So you probably want to obfuscate that as much as possible. And again, it's not something that you want to hide. It's just something that you also want to protect. And so kind of it's like what could be perfectly legal today and perfectly, you know, socially accepted in 10 years, in 15 years, that might not be the case anymore. And so when the public blockchain is then gone through in fine detail, what comes out of it and the heuristics that are made from that could, you know, it might mean something bad for you in the future. And I don't want to put you off completely transacting on the Bitcoin network. That's not what the purpose of the talk is. It's just, I think, following these privacy principles is something that you should be looking at, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And you might be revealing things that you may not want to have revealed in the first instance. So that's why I think that privacy is something that should be looked at. The other thing that I would also say is that with you know, traditional banking systems, Bitcoin transactions are irreversible as compared to traditional, you know, fiat systems. If someone was to steal your credit card, they could go around tapping all day, but then the bank will just reverse those transactions and you'll be made whole again. Whereas in the Bitcoin landscape, there is no central authority, there is no government that is going to come in and reverse a Bitcoin transaction for you. And so that, when you pair that over the lens of privacy, what that could mean for you in the future could be devastating. So that's kind of why I think privacy matters and why we should sort of look into this and pay attention to those details.
Absolutely. So, I mean, a couple of standout points in there to me were that you get some security by being more private. And if it doesn't seem important now, this could become, I do think it is important now, but I'm saying if it seems unimportant now to some people, it could very well become much more important in future, because you're right, the permanent nature of the ledger means that, say, an attacker can become far more sophisticated in future. A government may become far more authoritarian in future. Things that are legal now might not be legal in future. And you mentioned things like heuristics, which is how things can often be traced on chain. Something related to the point that I've just made that I've heard often from other people is that, oh, well, that's only really large organizations that have the sort of software that can do that. That's only very motivated parties that would probably spend the time or the money to try to do that. You think, yeah, that's kind of true now, but with the point of, economies of scale, you know, this will become more and more accessible. This sort of software will become more and more easy to use by an individual or by a group of potentially malicious actors. And so it won't just be large chain analysis organizations working for the government and regulators. It could be, again, very malicious actors that are looking for people that have spent their Bitcoin, that have maybe done some of the common mistakes that would make it easier for that person to then know how much Bitcoin you have, what addresses it's in, what kind of addresses they are. Are they multi-sig or single-sig? They start to know more about your setup. And again, that might not seem important now because people say, I've only got a certain amount of Bitcoin and it's only worth this much. What happens in 5 years, 10 years, 50 years time when it's time for retirement and your Bitcoin is now worth a whole lot more, but it's completely transparent, clearly on chain for someone, anyone who wants to know about it to come looking for it.
And the other point that I'd make to that is these are all fantastic points, but the other thing that you need to remember is that whilst it may only be available to institutions today, what if those institutions got hacked? What if their databases and everything that they got was now released out to the world? Then what? So now you've got, you know, all the heuristics, names, addresses, identifiables, and it's just one of those things that just it can get very, very ugly. And we've seen that happen with the Ledger attacks. What happened there was Ledger is a prominent hardware wallet in the space, and unfortunately their store, their web store, was hacked, and there was lots of details that got leaked around that, and still people are feeling the hurt of that. So it can be devastating towards people when, you know, you trust these institutions with, you know, volumes of data, and unfortunately somehow, in some way, shape, or form, that data gets leaked. It's not ideal.
And that is such something that people should plan for. Data leaks, data breaches, whether it's from a bad actor or whether it's through mistake, it is almost a guarantee. Just recently, there was that HubSpot. They're like a CRM, like a customer relationship management provider, and they do a bit of marketing. And there's about 30 different I don't think only exchanges, they're sort of other companies related to Bitcoin, but 30 different companies that use HubSpot that have had a lot of their customer data leaked. And there's some very big names in their customers. They have like BlockFi, Unchained Capital, Swan. And so, you know, those companies weren't doing anything wrong. They were trusting a third party, which seemed trustworthy enough, but that third party happened to have a bad actor. And now all of that data has been leaked. And so this is something that, yeah, people should factor into their what I like to like call a threat model or a threat plan, is like, you know, what do I need now for privacy and security, and what might I need in future? It's a really important point, definitely.
Agreed.
As something that is probably, I guess, more practical for people to think about now is, say if you get paid in Bitcoin, or say if you pay for things in Bitcoin, practically what could happen if you're not paying attention to privacy is that your employer would essentially know all the Bitcoin that you have, because they get to see the address that's being paid into. If you use, say, different addresses and you maybe merge those addresses from time to time, it then becomes very easy again for an employer to see how much money that you're keeping, or perhaps even where you're spending it. Same as with shops. If you go pay for something with Bitcoin in a shop, that shop owner, if they know anything about tracking something on chain, they can follow your transactions all the way back to the point of inception of where you first got that Bitcoin. So that's something relatively practical that would be happening, or could be happening right now, if people aren't using privacy practices. But the other things that we've been talking about, which are maybe a bit grander, that could happen in down the track years, that's still worthwhile to consider as well. So to bring this to something practical for people as well, what are some of the streams or the trains of thought that people should be keeping in mind when it comes to Bitcoin privacy? Like, what stuff should they be doing or thinking about?
Yeah, so I break down privacy into, I guess, three different streams. The first one is, you know, non-KYC versus KYC. I think that is something that is worth considering. It's not a binary option. It's not like one or the other. It is you can do both. So that's we'll go further into that. The other thing that you should be considering is the on-chain footprint that you are leaving, the permanent record on the blockchain that you are leaving behind. And the third thing that you should consider is network level privacy. So things about your internet connection and your IP address and those sorts of things, and your public keys, your master public keys, and where they're going. That's something that needs to be addressed as well. So those are my sort of key, you know, streams that I kind of like to think about when it comes to privacy with Bitcoin.
Makes sense. In terms of, maybe we'll just go through them, you know, point by point, and kind of explode some of the details out. So with the KYC and no KYC options, I would say contextually, probably most people that are getting into Bitcoin are starting their journey doing KYC purchases. And I I guess from my personal perspective and what other people have reported back to me anecdotally is that it tends to be a bit easier to get started with. I mean, it's not difficult to find a KYC exchange. They make sign up incredibly easy, and then purchasing and, you know, depositing, of course, before that, easy as well. There tends to be good liquidity. So it's like if you wanted to buy a very large amount quickly, you can normally do that pretty well on a KYC exchange. And of course, for some setups like, say, self-managed super or even businesses, the paper trail that's associated with KYC purchases can fit their model a little bit better. So I think that's where a lot of people come into it. But then as they learn a bit more about Bitcoin, they're keen to understand, you know, the no KYC approach. So I'm just curious, like, we've sort of talked about some of the privacy cons maybe of KYC, but like, are there any other issues with like taking a KYC approach? And then maybe we talk about no KYC pros and cons.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the pros are all there. You've labeled them quite well. You can do these things called large smash buys. You can develop a position that you're happy with in a quick and easy way. They make it incredibly easy for you to sort of, you know, get on the platform, get Bitcoin, and even withdraw it. And they also set up ways to automate a savings plan. So you can sort of buy Bitcoin on a periodic basis. So KYC exchanges provide, but also they provide peace of mind. It's less likely that you're going to get scammed or robbed. And you generally get, you know, high security benefits from reputable exchanges. Now, that's getting better over time. And those reputable exchanges are fairly well known, right, at this point. So I think the advantages are very clear with what a regulated exchange sort of offers in that regard, but it also comes off with some downsides, which is what we spoke about earlier with regards to this personal identifiable information. You know, passports, driver's licenses, selfies, these can harm your security and your privacy in the future if they're leaked or sold or stolen or something like that. And you know, you are also putting yourself onto a permanent list of people who have acquired Bitcoin. And so this can, again, be used against you in the future. And so it may have, you know, unintended consequences that you probably didn't realize at the time when you were signing up to these exchanges. So these are the pros and cons of a regulated exchange. As I said, you can do both, right? You can get onto an exchange and, you know, KYC and provide all those details and hope for the best and, you know, acquire large sums of Bitcoin very quickly. And for, you know, if you're doing it through your superannuation or something like that, then yeah, it presents a way for you. But then at the same time, you can also acquire on the side a non-KYC stack, which, yeah, I think the benefits of is basically that you don't have to give away your personal identifiable information, so you're less likely to be subject to, you know, actions of other people. And the thing with buying non-KYC is that generally speaking, you don't have an account with someone. You've got a wallet, which means you are actually in control of those coins from the moment that you receive them. And so they're not held on an exchange. They're not held by a third party. You get first dibs on the way you want to spend your money. And so, you know, you're also, the other thing is that you're leaving behind minimal paper trails on how much Bitcoin you've acquired, at what price, that sort of key information, and where you're withdrawing to as well is recorded by the KYC exchanges. So from the moment that you get on chain, you know, people already know where to look on the blockchain to see where to start to monitor your transactions. That's not necessarily a good thing. Whereas if you're using a peer-to-peer exchange, something like Bisc or HODL, this is where you can sort of, avoid those sorts of issues. However, there's no KYC is not a solution to everything. As you rightly mentioned, large volumes of buying Bitcoin are pretty tough to find. You might have to also pay a slight premium, so say 2-5% above the market price to acquire that Bitcoin. And you might not be able to get the desired position that you're looking for at the ideal time or the ideal price that you want it at. So it'll be a long, drawn-out journey when it comes to developing a non-KYC stack rather than, you know, a smash buy that you can just get on a regulated exchange. So that sort of gives you some of the pros and cons of KYC versus non-KYC.
That makes a lot of sense. And it sounds like it could be more suited for things like just dollar cost averaging, not being too impatient with when those trigger. And you're right that the benefits are you get that 100% self-custody the entire way through the process. And you've, again, got that security by privacy, by reducing that on-chain, traceability, by removing that initial identification process that you would have to do otherwise with a KYC exchange. So very good points. And yeah, Bisc and HODL, probably the best ways to go about it. When I've used them in the past, just to sort of experiment, they've seemed a bit clunky, but have definitely improved over time. And the support around them from their own community, as well as sort of other people that post on Twitter, different guides and whatnot, is definitely becoming much more accessible. So if it's something that you've tried in the past and couldn't get your head around, I would say have another look. And I mean, get involved in the communities that are around them too, because people are normally very happy to help. And otherwise, Bitcoin meetups, I think, another good way.
That's exactly what I was just going to say, Justin. So I think, you know, Bisc and HODL present fantastic ways for you to acquire Bitcoin without KYC. But attending your local meetups where you can meet people face-to-face, shake their hand, have a conversation with them, and then potentially do a trade if you know, the two parties are willing, that is another form of acquiring Bitcoin that does not involve KYC. The other way is to earn Bitcoin. Let's not, discount that. If you've got goods and services that you want to sell and that you want to bring to the world, sell them to people and ask for Bitcoin in payment. Perfect way of acquiring Bitcoin without KYC.
Definitely. And if you do happen to be a company that accepts Bitcoin payments, please reach out, let me know, because there is a list that's being developed called the Sat Spend List, which is just a list of Australian businesses that accept Bitcoin to try to give them a bit more patronage from Bitcoiners. And so, yeah, if you happen to fit into that category, please let me know. I'm happy to spruik whatever it is that you're selling. So I guess getting onto kind of practical tips for people, they kind of know the differences between KYC and no KYC, pros and cons, and also knowing that it's not a dichotomous thing where like you have to do one or the other. You know, you can do a bit of both. Do you have other, you know, tips around just how to improve your privacy with Bitcoin?
Yeah, I do. I'll go through them sort of one by one, but I think the first one that I'm going to advise upon is something that is very, very easy to do, but sometimes, you know, your tongue gets the best of you, and that is to keep your mouth shut. It works surprisingly well. If you keep, you know, to yourself in certain situations and not divulge too much information, like how much gains you've made and all those sorts of things, then that can somehow, that can sometimes protect you in certain scenarios. So the other thing that we also say in Bitcoin is never reveal how much Bitcoin you own. And I think that's there for a very good reason. And it's typically because of the irreversible nature of Bitcoin transactions. Once you lose them, that's it. It's gone. It's not coming back. So just keeping your mouth shut is a very, very important privacy tool in your toolkit to be able to, selectively reveal oneself to who you want. So just keep that in mind.
And that can be such a difficult one because Bitcoiners love to talk about Bitcoin. And if you get anyone who's remotely interested, we will go on and on. Well, I think the majority of Bitcoiners will. And interestingly, a question that commonly comes up, from no-coiners is, yeah, how much Bitcoin do you have? Which is not something that we would normally ask each other about, like how much does your house cost, or what's your superannuation, or what? Like, it's something that we don't normally talk about. But when we're talking about Bitcoin to people who don't own Bitcoin, it seems to be a common question, like how many do you have? And never answer that question, or maybe you answer the question with not enough. That's always the correct answer.
the correct answer is either not enough or just asking them the same question, how much is in your bank account?
Exactly.
That's kind of what you're trying to ask there. It's just not appropriate to ask those sorts of questions.
Mm. Any other tips around privacy?
Yeah, okay. So this is where we get into Bitcoin wallets. Now, there are certain things that are privacy no-nos in the Bitcoin space. One of them is to reuse addresses. So I'll give you an example of what may come in the future under a Bitcoin standard. Say, for example, I have a lawn mowing business. And I go over to Bob's place and I mow his lawn and I invoice him for 250,000 sats payable to a particular Bitcoin address. So then Bob will take his Bitcoin wallet and send it to me via that address that I provided him. Now, say, for example, I go over next door to Alice's place and I mow her lawn and I invoice her for 300,000 sats and I give the same address that I gave Bob, okay? Now, what can happen here is that Alice can look up that address and see, hey, someone's already paid to this address. He obviously, you know, Catan obviously owns this address. So why is he charging, you know, someone else 250,000 sats and me 300,000 sats? Am I getting ripped off here? So you can start to see sort of how heuristics can sort of come into play when people start to assign and make assumptions about certain things. This is why we don't reuse addresses, right? We basically, that is on the receiving end, right? So that's when we're receiving money. We do not ask someone to pay us to the same address multiple times. It is a privacy no-no. The same thing can happen on the spending end, right? So say, for example, I am withdrawing from, I am sending money to you, Justin. And I took a whole bunch of my earnings from this one address and I sent a payment to you of 50,000 sats because you helped me fix my lawnmower or whatever. I paid you out of those addresses that I earned. Well, Justin, guess what? You're going to look up that address and go, wow, Catan earned that much that day. That's pretty cool. Good on him. And that's something that I did not want you to know, Justin. I didn't want you to know how much I earned that day. But because of the Bitcoin public nature of the blockchain, you're able to see which address it came from. And this is why we don't reuse addresses. This is really, really important. Another thing that could be happening as well, in a more practical sense, is when you are withdrawing from an exchange from your into your own wallet, you might be giving your exchange the same address over and over again. Now, again, as I said, that might trip you up later when you go sending that Bitcoin to someone, because now they'll be able to see how much you're worth when it comes to, you know, your Bitcoin, and that is something that you want to protect. So, the lesson here is: do not use a Bitcoin address multiple times. Don't use static addresses. Don't use static donation addresses. That can get you into a lot of trouble as well. The address reuse thing just is, it's an absolute abomination and it should not be reused. Your addresses should not be reused. Good wallets will actually prevent you from reusing your address. It'll come up in red or something will flag to say, hey, you're about to reuse that address. Don't do that.
Okay. It's low-hanging fruit as well, isn't it? There can be such a significant improvement to privacy and then, of course, security by privacy by just not reusing addresses. And because most wallets will make that a relatively easy thing to do, it's just a matter of, you know, following that usual flow that a wallet will put you through and understanding that even though it might seem convenient to reuse an address, because that's what I thought when I first got into Bitcoin, that, this is kind of easier for me to keep track of things if I don't have too many of these addresses going around. I quickly learned why. And so I think the convenience you gain from it is really not that great. And it's just a matter of low-hanging fruit of improving your privacy.
That's right. And I think the other thing when it comes to address reuse is just be mindful that, you know, people can view that. It's not like, it's something that we've never been able to sort of solve before. Native digital peer-to-peer cash is not something that we've been doing for centuries. It's brand new. And so people will make these mistakes and then they'll realize that they've made a mistake and then they'll learn from there. So just be mindful. When you do get your wallet, you will have 2 billion addresses. Use them. There are 2 billion addresses in a typical Bitcoin wallet. It's enough to last you a lifetime. Which brings me sort of to my, I guess, next point, which is about addressing the transactions, or labeling, the transactions. that's kind of another hot tip that I would give you. In your wallet, good wallet software will allow you to label all of your transactions. So withdrawal from exchange, sending to X, Y, and Z supplier, received from BISC, or received from, you know, you should put these little identifiers in so that you are well aware of where that money came from and where that money is going. I think that's going to help you later on down the line. It is absolutely paramount to be labeling your transactions like that, because we're doing this in a peer-to-peer fashion. Usually, you know, in the fiat world, the bank will label everything for you. It knows where you spent your money and it knows where you received it from. Whereas in the Bitcoin space, there's no identifier on the blockchain that actually says where you received that from or where it's going. So that's where you have to take the onus and responsibility to sort of just label those things out. Good wallet software will do this.
That's right. And if you think that you'll remember what that UTXO was from in
weeks,
yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely no chance.
It's just like I've made that mistake before, and now I'm a diligent coin labeler. And it helps in future when you want to then construct a transaction that might take more than one UTXO. You can then intelligently choose from the remaining UTXOs which one you might like to, you know, merge those inputs with, and choosing from similar streams that you're not really sharing extra information by doing something like that.
And this is my third tip. UTXO management. First, let's define UTXO. UTXO stands for unspent transaction output, which is basically your coins, okay? So let's think about this in terms of practical ways. So say you have a wallet, you've got notes in your wallet. You've got a $50 note, you've got a $20 note, you've got a $10 note, and you've got a $5 note. When you go to a coffee shop and the barista asks you for $4.50, you are going to hand them the smallest UTXO, meaning the $5 note. Why? Because you don't want to reveal to the barista that you've got a $50 note, which means you at least have $45.50 in your wallet. I hope that kind of makes sense. So, but if you extrapolate that out into sure, this is not like a big example in, you know, from a barista's perspective. Wow, the guy knows that I've got $45 in my wallet. Not a big deal. But when you extrapolate this onto the Bitcoin network, well, it also means that what if you had a one BTC UTXO and you only needed to pay 50,000 sats? Why would you break that? Why would you break that big UTXO, revealing that to somebody else, when you can reveal a smaller UTXO or a smaller coin and get the job done that way without having to reveal too much about yourself? That is why UTXO management is so critical. And that's exactly what, you know, you were saying before. You can selectively choose which coin you would like to spend when you want to spend them, and match which one it is. So just like you would with your wallet, with notes, you would do the same thing with your Bitcoin, and good wallet software will allow you to tick, okay, this is the UTXO I want to use, and you spend that UTXO. This is called UTXO management.
I've also heard that called coin control. And sometimes yes, that's the term that I use. So I guess if anyone hears me saying that, that's exactly what I'm talking about, UTXO management as well.
Yes, that's right. Coin control is probably the better term there. And it's the more widely used one. I just use UTXO management because, well, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm managing my UTXOs.
That's it. Now, very true. I was curious to talk a bit about the types of wallets that we're referring to when we're saying, you know, ones that have things like labeling or give you a new address every time. However, just before we jump into that, I wanted to go back and maybe just clarify something that I think is really useful for Hardblock users, because this is like a sponsored show from Hardblock. So I know that some of the users will be listening into it. And we have it's like a dollar cost average, send from your bank account, automatically translates it into Bitcoin. And then if you want to, you can have that sent out automatically in a batch send on the weekend as well. However, it's really difficult finding a balance between convenience and privacy for that. So what users do is they put in an address and a threshold when they want that auto send, batch send to trigger. But what that means is if they're not going in and changing that address every time, say like every week or every 2 weeks or every month, however, you know, frequently there are their auto send triggers, it means they would be using addresses. Now, what I would suggest is that people don't do that. People should go in and change that address when they know that their next batch send is coming up. And we are trying to consider what would be the better way to go about that, perhaps having like a list of addresses that it cycles through. That way you don't have to change things too often. It might just be, you know, change everything after 10 sends. What we didn't want to do is actually have people put in their extended public key, which lets us know every single receiving address they could ever possibly generate, because that is really bad for privacy, even though it might be really great for user convenience. So I just wanted to explain that briefly, because I know some users might be looking at the features on Hardblock and then saying, but they're saying not to reuse my address, but then it seems like they're encouraging me to do it here. We're not really encouraging it. That's just a trade-off that we've had to make around convenience and privacy. But if you're listening to this podcast, what we're saying does definitely apply even to that feature. You know, make sure you change that address. Don't keep having it sent out to the same one. Just good to make that point. So in terms of wallets, in terms of being able to take a bit better control over privacy, what do you tend to use, or what do you tend to suggest?
So if you're on a desktop, my go-to is Sparrow Wallet. I think that that has sensible defaults. It's got all the features and more, which I'll talk about, that we just spoke about with regards to address reuse, UTXO management, labeling, all that sort of, all those features are all within Sparrow Wallet on a desktop environment, whether a Mac, Windows, or Linux. We'll also touch on which node you connect to as well. And I think Sparrow makes some good trade-offs and accessibility sort of advantages there when it comes to connecting to a Bitcoin node, which I'll touch on a little bit later. But then on a uniquely mobile wallet, I would suggest Samurai Wallet as my go-to. But unfortunately, it is only available on Android, which is probably one of the more key, I guess it's one of the key criticisms of Samurai Wallet. Those sorts of things I don't think are ideal. So I think, however, the wallet itself not only allows you to do all of these things that we've discussed, but it also has other cool privacy built-in features into the wallet. The first one is Whirlpool or coin joins. Now, this is where you can basically mix your coins up with other participants and produce UTXOs or break down your UTXO set into something that is very difficult for somebody to analyze on the chain to see where those coins were actually coming from before the mix, right? So when people, you know, when companies like Chain Analysis go through and look at the blockchain, they're able to make what's known as heuristics. And CoinJoin breaks these heuristics and assumptions that these companies make. And therefore, it allows you to spend a little bit more privately whilst breaking links between, you know, what's happened in the past of those coins. This is a really, really important feature when you are spending coins, but also when you are receiving as well. So in the context of a shop, you probably don't want to know where, you know, you are getting paid to. Same thing as an employee. You don't want your employer knowing where the coins are on chain anymore. And so Whirlpool can help to remove that. But also on the spending side, you don't want people knowing, just like I gave the example of your one BTC, you don't want them knowing that you've got, you know, one BTC, so you can give them a smaller UTXO. And that's what Whirlpool does. It breaks down your UTXOs and gives it into smaller chunks so you can offload them to people when you need to pay them.
I've heard a really good metaphor for the like Whirlpool and just CoinJoin mixing in particular is, say if you had five people, each of them had a gold bar. You melt those gold bars down into one big pool of gold, and then you I don't know what you'd call it, you remold five new blocks of gold and you distribute them back to those five people. And now it's impossible essentially to link back which block of gold post that mix is the one that is associated with the pre-mix block of gold, because it's all been smelted down into one large pile and then distributed back out into to five smaller ones. So, I mean, that might help conceptually for people to understand, especially if it's hard getting your head around UTXOs, perhaps just see it as, yeah, block of gold or like a dollar note, or it doesn't need to be a dollar, but like, you know, a denomination of notes being basically kind of torn apart and then remade again and distribute it out in an equal amount. So it's difficult to know who owns what pre and post.
That's exactly what a coin join is. That's, yeah, fantastic analogy there. The next... go on.
But maybe before we jump into to the next part, I was just curious. Well, not curious, sorry. It's a bit of an obsession of mine to understand some of the chain heuristics, because when we talk about those sort of things, when I was getting into it initially, it was very confusing to understand what kind of things like an analysis firm or someone who's not even an analysis firm that's maliciously trying to track transactions on the exchange. And so I wanted to rattle off just a few of them so people can understand the kind of level of detail that's being looked at algorithmically on chain. The obvious ones are what we've already talked about, like address reuse. You know, if multiple transactions are going into the same address, it is assumed, heuristically speaking, that it must be the same person that owns that address. There's another common one, literally called the common input ownership heuristic, which is essentially saying if you merge two inputs to create a transaction, so say if you choose two of your UTXOs to put into a transaction to pay someone, there's a heuristic that says, well, given those two UTXOs are on the input side, they probably belong to the same person. There's also one around self-spend. So say if you were to send Bitcoin from one UTXO to a new address, most people would just send it completely. So say if it's just for rounding simplicity, let's just say you have one Bitcoin in a UTXO and you wanted to send that to a different address for some reason. Maybe it's in a different wallet or something like that. If you send that full one Bitcoin UTXO into another one Bitcoin UTXO, that's considered to be just spending to yourself, because it's very rare that you would be spending a full UTXO perfectly. Because usually, say, if you go to a shop or you buy some services, it's going to end up being like not a round number like that, and especially not perfectly matching the UTXO that you're spending from.
And that's a heuristic in itself as well, rounded numbers. People, chain analysis will think that that is the actual payment. So if you're doing exactly 0.55 BTC and you get a change and you've broken down like a UTXO that doesn't have a round number, then they assume that that round number is the actual payment, and then the rest of it is your change. That's how they just assume it.
That's right. It makes a lot of sense. Two other things that I wanted to just throw out there that a lot of people probably don't realize with chain analysis and also wallets is that the change that you get from a transaction, there's a lot of information that can be gleaned from what that change address is and also the position. So some wallets, whenever you send a UTXO, there'll obviously be the spend amount, then there'll be the change that comes back to you. Some wallets will always position those two in the same way. So the spend is always first and the change is always second. That makes it very easy for someone looking on chain to know which is the spend and which is the change. Although wallets like Samurai Wallet and Catan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming Sparrow does this as well, they randomize that change output. So sometimes it's first, sometimes it's second, sometimes it's wherever else, how many outputs that you have. Does Sparrow do that too? Or is that just Samurai?
I think it's just Samurai at the moment, but I think Sparrow does it. I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you.
Yeah. That's okay. Well, I mean, I think that's a pretty cool thing anyway that often goes by kind of unnoticed, is like, where does that change show up? And if it's always in the same position, it becomes really easy for someone to monitor and know where your change is likely to be just based on past transactions. The other one is the script type or the address type. So people might be aware that legacy Bitcoin addresses start with the number one. Of course, the SegWit addresses that we use now start with BC1Q. And then, of course, there's one in between that's like a bit of an intermediary that starts with the number three, those addresses do. Now, if you were to, say, pay someone and you're using a BC1Q, like a SegWit address, and you're paying to them in a legacy address, but then the change is coming back to you in a SegWit or BC1Q address, it becomes easy, again, on-chain to say, well, the spend is going to a legacy wallet, but the change is going back to the same kind of address that the input came from. Therefore, that must be the change. So wallets like Samurai Wallet, as an example, will make sure that whatever the change address is, it's going to have to match the spend address. That way it becomes very unclear which one's the spend, which one's the change. I know that point's a little bit probably confusing. When I say it, it makes sense to me, but it's one of those things that I know there's a lot of assumed knowledge there, but just another cool way that some wallets will try to obfuscate that change information.
That was a fantastic explanation. I get it as well, but again, I've been in this space for quite some time. I totally understand what you're saying, but yeah, newcomers, they might feel that is a little bit more confusing, but I think, yeah, that is a fairly very good explanation of what you've just said there.
And I think just knowing that the wallet does it automatically, like for those features, especially with something like Samurai Wallet, it will be doing that for you. It'll be keeping a lookout to say, like, are you sending to a different type of address? That means we need to send the change back to you on that same type of address. That way no one can tell the difference. So just good to be aware, but also know that that's kind of happening automatically behind the scenes with certain wallets. So we're going to talk about other features. And then I jumped in and we had a bit of a tangent there on heuristics.
Yep.
So I guess other features, what sort of comes to mind to you for things like Samurai Wallet and Sparrow Wallet that's worthwhile?
So the key one, I think, is called Panims, or what's known as BIP47. BIP47 is basically reusable payment codes. Now, what this does is it allows me to pay you, if I wanted to, recurringly without having you to even send me an address, and without having to for you to reveal all of your, like your XPUB, if I wanted to continuously pay you in a certain way. So Panims provide a very, very good way for crowdfunding, for instance, but it's also a way to get paid in Bitcoin by just basically giving out this payment code that people can then just keep sending you, and it will just generate a new address each time, and the wallet will pay to that, or the sender's wallet will just pay to that. So it makes it a lot more private, and it makes it a lot easier for you to acquire Bitcoin and also to send Bitcoin. So this is a fantastic tool that has been around for quite a long time, but only Samurai Wallet has implemented it. Just recently now, with the new version of Sparrow, that's been implemented in there as well. And I think that other wallets are now looking at it and making sure that, you know, Bitcoin, BIP47 is now pretty much going to be in more and more wallets over time. So I think it just makes sense that people can use like a NIM to pay someone for their time or their services or whatever the transaction is for. So that is a very, very cool feature that, yeah, was only in Samurai Wallet. So only Samurai Wallet users could use it. But now it's getting a little bit more popularity, particularly now with Sparrow Wallet coming in on it. So that's one of the, yeah, great features that should be used.
Definitely. And my understanding is Blue Wallet has a bounty out at the moment to integrate Panims as well, or BIP47. So yeah, the more wallets that do it, the more useful it becomes, and then the more other wallets have to do it as well. So at least having two is great, one desktop, one mobile. But yeah, if Blue Wallet could do it too, because they have iOS on mobile, yeah, as well, which would be great. And to me, this just makes things like donations, or essentially using a static reusable address that doesn't give away private information, that lets people use Bitcoin probably how it intuitively feels like it should be used, where it's like you keep reusing the same address. Obviously, because we've just talked about that, people should know that that's not what we're usually using Bitcoin for. But with BIP47, you can do it that way. You can have this one address that people use, because if they link their Panim to it, all of a sudden they can generate all these new receiving addresses that are only known to you and them. And so you can imagine with some of the stuff that's gone on in Canada recently with the trucker protests, or even what's always going on in the world with dissidents leaving authoritarian or dictatorship type countries, or journalists that are publishing things that are, you know, perhaps quite ethical and legal, but maybe some very large either state or criminal actors don't want that to be published. Those kind of entities need to be able to receive donations, but in a way that's firstly private, but also convenient. And I could imagine going to one of those Canadian truckers in the protest and saying, I need you to, you know, set up a Linux server and then, you know, install like a Lightning node or Tor or BTC Pay server. And then that way you can receive, you know, donations directly. That's going to be way too much for most of them to do, and it becomes very infeasible. Whereas if it's just a matter of like, hey, sign up a Samurai or a Sparrow wallet, claim your Panim, and then let people know what your Panim is, and they can just donate directly to you without any other sort of intermediary or even other software that you need to run. Like, to me, that's revolutionary. It's great to see it getting a bit more steam now as well.
It has gone a lot more steam now that you know, some critical concerns were addressed or came to light rather. And so now I think wallet developers are starting to really look into Bit47 and implementing it into their wallets, which is great to see.
As a bit of trivia, my understanding was when Bit47 first came out, which was around maybe 2016, I want to say, because I think Samurai's had it in their wallet since about 2017. But when it first came out, that's around the time of the block size wars. And because I don't want to get too much in the nuance of how Paynims work, but one of the features, so you can generate receiving addresses with the other party and you can do it while they're offline, you need to actually send them a small transaction. And the thought of that time was that those small transactions, if Bit47 really takes off, it's going to really crowd the network. It's going to congest things. And it's going to take up, it's going to like create a lot of UTXO bloat where we just have like a lot of unspent transaction output sort of sitting there in you know, the memory of nodes. And that was considered to be potentially a bad thing that could become very unruly as time went on. And again, just leading to network congestion because the block size wars were all about saying we need bigger blocks. That way the blocks don't become, you know, too slow or too congested so we can, you know, process more transactions. Of course, since then, we now have other scaling solutions that didn't become the problem that it was expected to be. So now I think Paynims will have a resurgence with some of that that initial FUD gone.
Agreed. Great summary.
Thank you. I like trivia sometimes with Bitcoin. The history is always so rich and it starts to then bring into context why we don't do some things which might make so much sense now to do. You know, it just made sense culturally at the time to not do this because it seemed like maybe a too big of a vulnerability to introduce. So it's good that things move slowly on Bitcoin, even though that can be frustrating. I think it means that we don't break things and we introduce them probably when they're needed the most of the time. So in regards to Samurai and Sparrow Wallet, I'm aware that they've got some post-mixed spending tools as well. So say if you bought some Bitcoin, you put it through a Whirlpool mix, which breaks that deterministic link. So it's very difficult for anyone who even knew your original pre-mix address to then follow it through the mix. So you've gained a bit of you know, forward privacy there. When it comes time to then spend from your mixed Bitcoin, is it useful to maybe talk about some of the type of spend tools that they have, or maybe even just common mistakes that people can make when spending their mixed coins, because they think, these are private Bitcoin now, so I can do whatever I want with them and no one's ever going to be able to link it back.
Yeah, so there's a few trip-ups that some people tend to make. Now, with Whirlpool, what happens is it will break down. So say, for example, you've got a 1 BTC or just over 1 BTC, and you put that through to the mix and it breaks it down into 0.5 and 0.5. And there'll also be a little bit of a change left over. And that change there can, if you spend it incorrectly or you spend it alongside something else, your initial spend or the spend, then you may be able to reveal or unwind all of the mixing that has happened previously. So what you want to do is segregate that out. And your Samurai Wallet and Sparrow Wallet do this automatically, and they put it in what's known as the bad bank. And so you keep those UTXOs there until such time as you want to, for example, you can donate them to someone, or you can run them through the mix again when you have more bad bank accumulated. You can run those through the mix, and you just leave them there. You don't actually spend those coins until such time as you really, really want to get rid of those bad UTXOs. So that's kind of one of the trip ups that they have. Now, they also have post spend tools. That there are these post spend mixes that basically do away with some of the ownership, the heuristics that chain analysis uses. So one of them, as you mentioned correctly, was the common input ownership heuristic, whereby all inputs are assumed to be by that one party. Well, a post-mix spend that you can do on Samurai Wallet and on Sparrow Wallet is that you can utilize a friend's UTXOs to create a coin join or like a mini coin join between the two of you and then spend that. And so what that does is it actually breaks the heuristic saying that it was only, you know, your UTXOs that spent that money. it actually obfuscates that whole sort of heuristic there. So that's what some of these post-mix tools do for you to, you know, for them to sort of get confused around what is actually happening on chain here. Another one that they have is called Ricochet. Basically, what that does is it allows you to give hops to your destination. So there have been instances where people give Bitcoin to companies, and those companies go, oh, we don't like that because it just came out of a Whirlpool mix. We don't like that. So what can happen is you can put that through a Ricochet where it creates plausible deniability and it hops your UTXO from one address to another address to another address, and then you know, about six addresses later, then it will send to the correct address. Mm-hmm. So when anyone's referring back to the chain, well, that could be anyone's payment there, or any intermediary could be involved in there. So that gives some levels of more plausible deniability. And these are what's known as post-mix tools that Samurai Wallet have algorithmically created. And so that, you know, your on-chain footprint is something that is much more harder to gauge exactly what you've done.
Definitely. And they basically have one for seemingly everything, because there's, from my my recollection, there's Stonewall, which is like you do a spend that looks like a coin join, but it's actually not a coin join. It's you that's just right. spending. And then they've got the Stonewall 2X, which is you doing a coin join with someone else. Yeah, and that's the one that you just mentioned before, yep. where you get like a friend's UTXOs, mix it with yours, and then you spend to someone. And then they also have the one called Stowaway,
yep.
which is where you, it looks like a self-spend because it's like you're spending the full UTXO to yourself, but actually you're spending it to a different person. Which then kind of mixes up both of your, what we call the transaction graphs, or basically all the history of all the UTXOs and addresses related to that will then look like they belong to the same person, even though they're two very different people. So yeah, they've got sort of something for every scenario and in each of those really common chain heuristics that are quite useful for chain analysis companies.
Totally. And Sparrow Wallet is looking to bring out all of those features as well, or if they already haven't got them. I think they've sort of started to now just build them in into Sparrow Wallet as well. So yeah, those are two options or two wallets that you can really start to dig into some of the privacy features that are available there.
Definitely. So I know I get the question a lot from people around Lightning Network, just to find out, you know, how private it is. In fact, most people actually just come with the assumption that it is private, because normally the way that it's framed is that, why would I need to know about all the on-chain heuristics and things like mixing and coin joining if I can just use Lightning? And so I'm curious to get your opinion. I guess I've got a couple of thoughts on this as well. And I know that just from past discussions that you might not be the Lightning expert compared to the on-chain privacy expert, but could you weigh yeah. in a little bit on what you reckon about Lightning Network privacy?
So the other thing that, sorry, I forgot to mention as well, is that the other heuristic that that they also use is multi-sig. So multi-sig addresses stick out like sore thumbs on the blockchain. Why? Because they're longer in the addressed, you know, the characters are a lot longer. And you can also see whether it's a 2 of 2 or a 2 of 3 or a 3 of 5. You can tell which one it is. And so that is being improved with the use of Taproot. But Lightning at the moment, when you open and close a channel, which is required to open up a channel, you need to create an on-chain transaction. You need to make a commitment. And that commitment is a 2 of 2 multisig. So straight off the bat, most of these 2 of 2 multisig transactions that are occurring on the chain, well, they're just assumed to be either Lightning open or a Lightning close. And then where they go, that's kind of where they sort of, when you come back on chain, well, that's kind of where they sort of start the analysis back up. But also with the Lightning Network, there is active surveillance that is being conducted on there. And also, if you sort of, just in terms of the Lightning Network, the accessibility for it, to do it in a self-custodied way is far more significant than, as you mentioned before, if a trucker wants to just open up Bit47, get a Samurai wallet and get going, that is a lot easier. Whereas with Lightning Network, it is a little bit more involved. You need to manage channels. You need to open up where you think the liquidity is going to be. Receiving liquidity is also somewhat of an issue. So there's a lot more to think about when it comes to the Lightning Network if you want to do this in a self-custody way. If you don't want to do it in a self-custody way, then you can use another, like a wallet of Satoshi or something like that. But then those come with, obviously, some level of surveillance in there and monitoring that goes on with that as well. So what I'm saying is, I guess in life, really, there are no solutions. There's only trade-offs. And I think that's what needs to sort of be spelt out here, that yes, Lightning Network does make things a little bit more private in some ways. And then in other ways, it doesn't. So just be mindful of that.
That's a really good point, trade-offs, because this happens a lot, probably in most industries, but especially privacy, where it feels very all or nothing, but it very rarely is all or nothing. It's a process, and it really depends on your threat model. So using one custodial service like a wallet of Satoshi or Moon Wallet or Blue Wallet could actually give enough privacy depending on what the person's trying to do and who they're trying to obfuscate that from. Like if you're just using a local shop and you want to pay through Lightning, then I imagine it's going to be very difficult for that local shop owner to then trace everything back through the chain. Having said that, playing devil's advocate with my point here, you know, if in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 15 years' time, it's actually much easier to do that sort of that tracing, that information is all still there on chain. So it is still something that's susceptible in future. I guess what I've heard and seen a lot recently on Twitter is that people saying, oh, look, if you are not just use one custodial service, but use two. So say if you go into a Blue Wallet and then translate to Moon Wallet or then to Wallet of Satoshi, hell, even use three of them. All of a sudden by using three different custodians or two different custodians, that's as private as a, you know, say an on-chain Whirlpool mix. I don't really agree with that at all. All you're doing is you're separating your third-party risk out to two parties rather than just having it in one, which sure is better than one. But it still doesn't give you that zero link privacy that, say, a Whirlpool mix might do.
I would agree with that analysis there, Justin. Yeah, I don't think it's the same. And I think that zero net link Whirlpool transaction is going to, you know, protect, you know, what's going to happen pre the mix and what happened after the mix as well. So I think that gives me a little bit more comfort than going through like hops of Lightning Network to then come out and pop out on the other end. However, I do concede that can break some levels of analysis as to, you know, where you entered into and then where you came out of. There's another one called Bolts Exchange, which people are using. But basically, it is custodial as well. So, you know, you send them Lightning and then they send you on chain straight away. Now, the susceptibility of that to being, you know, attacked or a key, it is a one shop that can be attacked, that could also be there as well. So whilst it may be okay today, it may not be there in the future. So that's another thing to consider as well.
Look, this is probably a little bit of a tangent, but I haven't heard a whole lot about Bolts Exchange, is it called, or Bolts Swap?
Yeah, Bolts Exchange. So basically what you do is you send Bitcoin Lightning to them and they then ask you, well, where do you want this paid out on chain? And then they send you that amount on chain. They clip a little bit of a fee, but at the same time, you now have some coins that have just popped out of the Lightning Network without having to open or close channels. And you can use it to rebalance as well. So that's what, you know, people are using it for.
Gotcha. That makes sense. So I think people probably have some practical things to take home in terms of software to consider, as in wallet software, so like Samurai or Sparrow. Obviously, a bit about Lightning there. And if you wanted to make Lightning more private, I would say mix first and then enter Lightning. But of course, you know, we're not experts on Lightning. I think that's just like a good bit for people to keep in mind. But I'm curious because you mentioned also network level privacy.
Yeah. This is what I wanted to get into.
Yeah, yeah. How should we sort of start with that?
Okay. So the first thing that I think you need to sort of understand is that your Bitcoin node is your gateway into the Bitcoin network. And how those, connections are being made to other peers can you know, it can be really easy to find out which IP addresses are coming from, you know where. But the other thing is whose node are you using? If you're using your own Bitcoin node, that is something that is more preferable to then using somebody else's Bitcoin node from a privacy perspective. The reason is because if you connect to somebody else's Bitcoin node, you are giving them basically your XPub, which is your, you know, those master public keys that we were alluding to earlier. And so what that means is that they can now see all of the status of your transactions and your entire wallet history. And so that's not ideal from a network level privacy either. So they can find out which IP address, you know, owns a particular XPub, and then potentially, you know, trace back who that wallet belongs to. It's not ideal. This is why you should be using your own Bitcoin node to access the Bitcoin network. And so these sorts of things can, you know, using a VPN, using your Bitcoin node over Tor exclusively, these things can help obfuscate your real IP address and your location. And so these are the tools that you can sort of use. Now, in Sparrow Wallet, what you can do is, if you don't have your own Bitcoin node, first of all, it doesn't put you on a Bitcoin node by default. Okay, it does not put you on any node. You have to select which node you would like to use. So Sparrow Wallet has a nice function whereby you can use a group of trusted Electrum servers or servers that you can connect to, and that would be if you don't have your own Bitcoin node. Or you can connect to your own Bitcoin Core or to your own Electrum server. So these settings, these default settings, are really sensible and are active for you to make the choice as to which one you want to do. So if you're just starting off, you might want to use, for example, Luke Child's Electrum server or Blockstream's Electrum server, people who have somewhat of a reputation in the space, rather than, you know, potential other, you know, other bad actors in the space. So you make that sort of, and I think Bitaroo also provides that as well. So that's one option. And then you've got, you can connect to your own Bitcoin node, and that would be the preferred option of network level privacy, because you're not querying somebody else. You're querying your own Bitcoin node as to what's the status of my transactions. That's the better way of doing things when it comes to network level privacy. And that's what we talk about when we say network level privacy. Are you using your own Bitcoin node, and how is that Bitcoin node connecting through to other participants on the network? That's really what we're talking about there.
That makes a lot of sense. And would the suggestion be, if Tor is available, to make sure that is enabled?
Yeah, definitely. So for example, with Samurai Wallet, when you connect to their Bitcoin node, you can run it through Tor. So the only information that they have is an XPub, but they can't correlate it back to an IP address. So that, you know, it helps with your privacy in that regard. Now, if you don't want to use Samurai Wallet servers at all, you can run what's known as a Samurai Wallet Dojo, which basically acts as the back end, or your Bitcoin node, an entry point into the Bitcoin network. And so a lot of these packages and these node packages, like Umbrel and Raspberry Blitz and MyNode, they will have Dojo implemented into them.
That makes a lot of sense. What is the uptake of using Tor with, say, Lightning nodes? I'm curious. That's something that is sort of a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but yeah, is that pretty standardly integrated to?
By default, a lot of the communications that's happening on Lightning Network nodes is through Tor, because of all of these packages, like MyNode and Umbrel and all these guys. They're natively putting all these Lightning nodes over Tor. So by default, you are getting the protection, the network level protection, when you fire up a Lightning node with these packages. And that's excellent to see. However, it does come at costs. You might see that your Lightning transactions are somewhat clunkier than if they were going through ClearNet. It takes a little bit of time for the route to go through. It just adds a couple of, I wouldn't say, you know, it might take a couple of seconds instead of milliseconds to be able to go through your transaction. It's a little bit of a pain, but I hope that things improve over time.
And I would say that inconvenience of waiting a little bit longer is probably much worth the privacy
that you benefit exactly from. That's right.
For anyone who doesn't know what Tor is, I mean, this can be a very high level description. How would you describe it?
So Tor is basically hopping your traffic through encrypted tunnels set up by multiple peers across the entire Tor network. So rather than using your own IP address to query other people's servers, you're basically creating a little tunnel by which, an encrypted tunnel by which your traffic is being passed through multiple locations around the world and then going out through what's known as an exit node. And that exit node then sends all that information back to you. So basically what you're trying to do is obfuscate the IP address and bounce it around the entire world and then receive and send the information that you want. So that's kind of at a high level what Tor does. Obviously it adds to latency, right? So, you know, you're going through the whole world and then you're popping out and then you're coming back in again. So you will see that a slight degradation in performance of your internet connection as a result of that. So that's the trade-off there. You're getting privacy and convenience. That's the trade-off with, it seems like, everything in Bitcoin.
That makes sense. And I guess a bit of trivia for people, Tor stands for the onion router. The reason it's called an onion is kind of the way that it goes through or bounces through those nodes in a network, whereby each node doesn't have all the information about, say, you, the location that the message originated from or the data originated from, as well as what the data actually is. So what I mean by that, like a cool metaphor that I've heard about this is, like, I send an envelope to someone and it has their name addressed on it. They know that that envelope has come from me, but when they open the envelope, all that's inside is another envelope addressed to someone else. So they then send that envelope on to that someone else. So they don't really know what's actually in, you know, the final envelope. They just know, I need to pass this on. That second person or third, depending on how you see it, they get their envelope, they open it up, and there's just another envelope inside with another person's name inside. They then send that on, that final person opens their envelope, and that's the actual data. And then they say, okay, I'll go give this data to the final destination. What it means is that, you know, people at the very beginning or the middle, so like the entry node or the middle, you know, receiving or intermediary node, they don't know what your data was. In fact, the middle person doesn't even know where the data came from. The first person knows where it came from, but they don't know the end result. And the very final exit node, they know the data, but they don't know where it came from. If that kind of makes sense, it's like an onion. You're peeling back layers, and each layer has a little bit of information about the previous hop and the next hop, but they don't get to put the whole thing together in terms of where this came from and what it actually is used for.
Fantastic explanation, mate. Really good.
Thank you. Now, VPNs in here is, I guess, something to keep in mind too, because say if you use Tor, your ISP knows that you're using Tor. Generally in Australia or most Western countries, that's not a big deal. If you used, say, a VPN as well as Tor, then that would be obfuscated. It would look like you're just connecting to a VPN server and it wouldn't be known that you're using Tor. Is there any other benefits to doing that, do you think? Like running both a VPN and then having, you know, connect to your wallet through Tor and then your wallet to your node through Tor?
I don't think that's the key, I guess, you know, the key sort of thing with VPNs. For me, the way that I use VPNs is I run it at my router so that all of my traffic is going throughout the entire home is running through a VPN. Mm. Now, unfortunately, we have laws here in Australia that if you go and, you know, connect to your ISP, they actually log all of your queries and they collect what's known as metadata. Now, it's loosely defined what metadata is, but basically they have an obligation, your internet service provider has an obligation to keep your metadata, which could mean, you know, websites you've accessed, where you've gone, what you've searched, those sorts of things, up to a period of 2 years. So if you are going through your internet service provider's what's known as a domain name server, then that becomes very, very easy for them to start logging you. Whereas if you change that and go through a VPN, then they know how much traffic you have sort of uploaded and downloaded, but they don't know what traffic that they have actually that they've actually sent and received. So that is kind of where you would use VPNs as a way to obfuscate your IP address so that other participants don't know where that traffic sort of originated from, and you're sort of hiding in a crowd because everybody else is using that same IP address. And that's kind of what the privacy guarantee there is that this central third party is running all of your traffic. Now, this central third party is someone who does know all of your traffic, but at least it's not the ISP, which you know are doing, you know, logs or maintaining logs for up to 2 years. So that's kind of the network level privacy that I think people should look towards by removing themselves or opting out of that whole logging system and going through a VPN.
That makes sense. You're sort of distributing the trust to a third party that is perhaps more trustworthy, has less incentives to monitor you. And in fact, they're incentivized not to log. And most good VPNs will have some sort of audit to try to prove that they're not logging, as well as many, many promises of not logging, warrant canaries, that sort of thing. So even though you're just sort of shifting the third party risk, you are choosing someone that you expect has a little bit less third-party risk than, say, your ISP, which you know is actively monitoring you by law.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right, Justin.
Well, to me, it's probably a good amount for people to know about now, like the network level, the wallet and on-chain level, and then, of course, all the way back to KYC and identification and linking that to your Bitcoin. We're touching on nodes now, and I'm really keen to get you back on for another episode to talk specifically about nodes, as well as things like BTC Pay Server. Having said that, is there any nodes that you suggest in the context of privacy that people check out after this this episode?
Yeah, so I would look into Ronin Dojo. They've just brought out a box called the Ronin Dojo Tanto box. I think that is a privacy-focused Bitcoin node that people can purchase and use. But then there's also the Raspberry Pi packages that are out there. So, for example, Mynode, Umbrel, Raspberry Blitz and Start 9. Those are the key ones there. And they all have their pros and cons and what they offer and what they don't offer and those sorts of things. So you'll just have to sort of see what you like and what the advantages are and go from there from each of those offerings. The one that I prefer, though, the one that I do is I build things sort of myself, and I go through and teach how to build a Bitcoin node from scratch. And so I've got videos on YouTube that specifically, basically take a computer right from start to finish, install Bitcoin, run it through Tor, install Ronin Dojo, install an Electrum server, and I do it all from scratch, and I show the viewer how it's done. I think that just presents more of a self-sovereign approach to this. And I think the fact that you can do it shows that you don't have to rely on these trusted third parties to be able to do that, that you can use the self-sovereign approach of just getting software from the internet and running free and open source software on your computer. So that's my preferred method, but I'm glad that all these other ones exist because it is a little bit more technical and a little bit more time consuming.
True. And I would recommend anyone to get in touch with you if they are keen to set up a node and they're not sure exactly how they want to run it, or more so what features they want to have in it, because by setting up the way that Catan sort of finished off there, it gives you many, many options and it's more customizable. Whereas as an example, bit of like personal disclosure, I run a Ronin Dojo node, which is really best for backing a Samurai wallet and for making use of a lot of the privacy features that we've talked about today. And like some of the things I like about Ronin Dojo is they are trying to set it up with privacy and security in mind. So they close all potential ports that, you know, shouldn't be needed otherwise. They try to remove a lot of, say, like repositories or like the stuff that underpins the software. They're trying to get rid of the stuff that's superfluous, so just to remove attack vectors. And that stuff sounds really cool, and it means it's got really good stable uptime. You feel very secure with it. But if you wanted to, say, run a Lightning node as well, you would need to set up a whole separate one. If you would want some of the cool stuff that comes with things like Umbrel or Citadel or Start 9, what I'm thinking here is like maybe password managers or some self-hosting stuff, that you wouldn't be able to do on a Ronin Dojo. So having something that is more of a customizable box or VM or something that you run yourself and set up yourself with Catan's help, that would make a whole lot of sense. And it gives you that customizability and you can kind of explore and experiment before you figure out what you really want to use it for. And of course, by doing that, you're really becoming competent in the kind of skills, the tech skills that you'll need to be a good Bitcoiner. And it helps you understand Bitcoin at a deeper level as well.
Completely agree.
So we've got, well, I mean, I think we've covered pretty much everything that we needed to cover in regards to privacy. I had maybe a couple of other just general questions to ask you. We'll do like a bit of a rapid fire at the end here. But is there anything else now that we're sort of capping off the privacy stuff? Anything that you feel like, yeah, we should either touch on that we haven't already, or anything that is really just worthwhile to highlight? Like any final thoughts on privacy?
Yeah. Look, I don't think that the discussion's all out there. I think we've gone through a fair bit of material here. Go through and see what you sort of, you know, what you want to pick up and run from it. Start taking your privacy a little bit more seriously and just do something. Don't just sit there and sort of, you know, go, oh, okay, well, someone else is looking at it and I'll, you know, it'll happen when it happens. Start to actively do something, even if it's small, even if it's just, you know, learning about how to run a VPN. That is going to help you along your journey a little bit better when it comes to your digital security and your privacy, because everything's now becoming digital. And so, you know, if we're now transacting digitally, we're chatting digitally, we're doing all sorts of things all over, you know, all over cyberspace, we want to remove or limit the amount of information that's there about ourselves. And so I think that's kind of, you know, taking these small steps over time can help in a really big way later on down the track. So please do this with some level of urgency.
Absolutely. As look, I'm not sure who originated the quote, but I'm just going to accredit it to Matt Odell, because that's where I've heard it over and over again. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. You know, you can have pretty good privacy, you can have good enough privacy. It doesn't need to be perfect, but I think a lot of people stop because they feel like it needs to be perfect, or they're too far gone. You know, there's always steps that you can take, and they're always very valuable steps to take. I think like privacy is probably a good epitome of low time preference, where it might not seem important now, but to pay attention to it now will really save you a lot of hassle and time and probably money in future as well. So keep that in mind. If you're trying to adopt a low time preference with most things in life, as Bitcoin often, you know, forces people to do or encourages them to do, this is one of those low time preference things. And if you like the Bitcoin ethos, if you like what Bitcoin is trying to accomplish in the world, I think it's good to respect or at least acknowledge that it came out of the cypherpunk movement. Look, probably other movements as well, but the cypherpunk movement was integral to Bitcoin's development and release. And they are very much grounded in privacy and the right for privacy and the need to fight for privacy as well. So, you know, if you really get and are keen on the Bitcoin ethos, then being private with it, and being private, like in other aspects of life as well, is it's an important thing to try to factor in. Very wholesome.
Just one final, last, quick tip. Yeah. When it comes to privacy, there was one thing that I like, as you mentioned, even if you're just in your personal life, instead of ordering things to your home address and giving away your home address to, you know, multiple various parties, grab yourself a parcel locker and get everything shipped to that little parcel locker. I think that particularly Bitcoin related goods as well. So if you want, you can get a free Australia Post parcel locker. You sign up with them, and then all of the vendors that you use, you just give them the parcel locker, and then you go and collect it as and when you need it. I think that's a really good privacy sort of no brainer, really.
Definitely. And when things like Ledger has a leak that gives away the majority of their customers' data, you would circumvent, you know, the downsides to that, where people would have the parcel locker as an address, not your home address. I'm not sure how Australia Post feels about using a name that's not yours, but you might want to, I don't know, just use your first name or something. That's possible, as long as that's not illegal or doesn't, you know, make you not able to get your mail. But I think you're not using all of your most identifying details when you're having something sent to you. But especially, like Yitan just said, having it not sent to your home address, getting a free parcel locker, it's just a no-brainer, really. So I guess final queries, we'll do like a bit of a rapid fire. There's a lot of things to be bullish on in Bitcoin, obviously, probably goes without saying. However, do you feel like there's something going on at the moment that you're most bullish on with Bitcoin?
Honest, at the moment, I'm bullish on the privacy. People are now starting to take you know, actionable steps to improve their privacy. I think that that is a bullish sign. I'm also starting to see people waking up to the need for Bitcoin and what it presents. I think that's a bullish sign. People are now sort of going, hold on, is my money actually mine? When I'm there at 65, will I actually be able to get out this superannuation money? People are starting to question, and I love it. I'm here for it. So I think that's my most bullish thing. People are actually starting to wake up, and it's really, really good to see.
It's exciting, isn't it? And I think people are not just thinking like, is my money actually my money? Some people are even starting to think, is it even money in the first place?
Exactly. What is money? Hold on. I've been entering into this contract my whole life to collect Australian dollars, and you're telling me this is not even money?
Exactly. You know, I think that's very true. More people are waking up to the need for privacy, the need for Bitcoin. And it's almost like the more people wake up, the more, I'll just sort of very broadly say the state, you know, government and regulators, the more they try to clamp down. But then I believe that's pushing people further and further down this one-way street of the need for privacy and the need for things like Bitcoin, like actual real money that you get to hold without the counterparty risk.
Totally agree.
Now, on the flip side to that, what do you think is the biggest threat to Bitcoin? Or do you think there is a big threat to Bitcoin?
So I think there are some certain threats, but overall, I think I'm bullish on Bitcoin. So some of the things that I don't like seeing is when, you know, things are getting blacklisted, Bitcoin privacy is being invaded, fungibility of Bitcoin is becoming, you know, something of a discussion point. That's not great. However, overall, I am still bullish on it because it's got the largest network effect. It is one of the, you know, like if you want to transact without censorship, it is the tool, the premier tool to be able to do that. It offers the ability to actually own your money, not go through a central authority. There are just too many pros to Bitcoin that just outweigh any cons. And the cons are constantly being looked at and solved and improved upon. I can't see how this thing just stops tomorrow or in 10 years' time or 15 years' time or 20 years' time. I truly hope that I'm right here, and I think I am.
I'm a relatively skeptical and I would probably even say cynical person. Just a life of various things have probably led me to that conclusion. But I'm always looking at the flip side. I'm always looking at things to be bearish about or potential threats. Some of that's to try to then circumvent it, of course, but some of it's also to make sure I protect myself in the long term in terms of wealth and financially. I'm exactly aligned with you in that I'm bullish on Bitcoin. I'm bullish on Bitcoiners as well. And I really don't see anything that is like an existential threat to Bitcoin. I think we always need to be diligent. I think things like attacks on privacy and fungibility are really important that we, you know, acknowledge and then keep working to circumvent or to fix. But at the same time, I do feel like we're on a good track. And I do feel like more and more people are finding out about it, which just propels us even further.
And yeah, we can build that economy that we want to see. I'm here for it. I'm here for the peer-to-peer economy where people, I can, you know, pay people in sats for the goods and services that I want and need. I'm all here for it.
Absolutely. Now, final question before final thoughts, if there are any final thoughts, is are there any tangent topics that Bitcoin got you into that you had no idea that were either maybe related to Bitcoin in the first place? The example I often give here is carnivore. So like carnivore diet, where you're kind of eating the vast majority of only meat, getting rid of seed oils, lots of, you know, vegetables and fruit and carbohydrates. There's no point kind of going on about carnivore, but I think it is one of those tangents that a lot of Bitcoiners seem to fall into that they had no idea was related to Bitcoin and probably isn't related to Bitcoin. It's more just like Bitcoiners like to question and research. But anything like that that's come up for you where you're like, holy shit, I'm doing this thing now. No idea that I would be doing this, but Bitcoin's kind of strangely led me to this tangent.
Yeah, for me, it's self-hosting. That was my thing. I thought, wait, hold on. If I'm self-hosting my money, why am I not self-hosting my data? If I can create a Bitcoin server via a Bitcoin node, well, hold on. I can create all sorts of servers. So instead of using Google Cloud or the iCloud or these trusted third parties, I'm going to start decentralizing everything. So now I use Nextcloud. I host my own password manager. I host my own Matrix server. I host my own, I've got a whole bunch of things. I've got my own social media in the form of Mastodon. Like I have gone down the rabbit hole of self-hosting everything such that all of my data is actually owned by me and not by some, you know, corporation who's looking to perform some sort of AI or sell my data or who knows what they're doing with it. And so that's what I'm trying to, that's the literally the rabbit hole, the tangent that I got led down.
I love it. And I do have to go through your PF Sense guide because that's something that's kind of my next project that I've had for a little while and I'm now getting some time to do it. So I've got to pull the trigger on it because I think when you do start to take things like self-hosting your money seriously, it just makes sense to naturally extrapolate that out to other things that are private and precious. It's like maybe a bit of a tangent example or story here that's really opened my eyes to it. I moved into a new place and obviously got like NBN set up. And I understand how to use routers and modems and everything else. So I followed the instructions on their site of like setting the modem up, but still couldn't get it to work. And so I ended up calling them up and just explained what I'd done. And they said, all right, can you just reset the modem? So I reset the modem. And now keep in mind, this is a modem I've had for probably like 5 or 6 years through various ISPs. So not related to this ISP at all, but I reset my modem and then everything was working fine. And I said to the guy, like, I don't understand. How does that work? Because I'd set everything up to your instructions, didn't work, but I've now reset the modem to factory settings, which have nothing to do with this ISP. And now it's working. He said, oh, because we have the availability once you have it reset to factory settings that we can actually get in and set it up appropriately. And sometimes that's very useful for kind of elderly clients that aren't very kind of, handy with these sort of things. And sometimes it's just a quicker approach to take. And at first I was like, wow, that's great convenience. I can just do that from now on instead. And then I thought, well, I don't know if I like that too much. They can actually now get into the router that I'm now connecting all my other devices to, including something like my node. And of course, there's laws, there's regulations, there's all sorts of things about like what they can and they can't either dabble with or monitor. But at the same time, that stuff can change and you never know what's private and precious until, well, maybe it's not. So it's one of those things that made me think I do need something that sits one step beyond the modem that belongs to the ISP, like a PF Sense router, and then have everything else going through that instead.
Justin, I can tell you now, we are going to have a very, very long conversation about that. Yeah, probably this weekend.
I'm really keen because some of that is like learning about networking, learning about all this sort of stuff. It takes a lot of time. I do like it. But the thing is, if you don't do it long enough or consistently enough, you start to lose it. Because I went down this rabbit hole a long time ago about all these sort of network privacy things. But because I haven't used it for a while, now that I'm looking at it again, I have a lot of questions. So I need a technically minded person to answer my very detailed oriented questions. So that'll certainly help.
Yep, no, definitely. Looking forward to it.
That's great. Well, any final thoughts before we finish up?
No, I think Bitcoin privacy is something that we should all sort of take in our own responsibility. Just like we're taking responsibility of our money, we should also be taking responsibility of our privacy. And, you know, try not to give away as much information as, more than what you need to. Mm. If you focus on that and then, you know, keep yourself private in those matters, I think over the longer term, it's only going to benefit you. So keep trucking along.
Well said. Where can people follow you on social media or even the Ministry of Nodes website? What's that URL?
Yep. So if you go to ministryofnodes.com.au, you'll find our website. There you can book in a consulting session with us if you want to explore these topics a little bit further. We've got a Twitter handle at Ministry of Nodes, so you can follow that. And we've also got our YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Ministry of Nodes, which has all of our YouTube material. And you can follow me personally on _K3TAN.
Great. And I'll add that all to the show notes as well, in case anyone's scrambling to write anything down.
Perfect.
Well, thanks very much for your time. Really enjoyed the conversation. And I'm pretty sure this will be useful for people. It really doesn't matter where they're at their Bitcoin journey. I think this is some stuff that people are only scratching the surface of. So hopefully there's some practical things to go on with. And again, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Just get started.
Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. Anytime, really. If you liked or think this content would be useful, please share it around. any comments or suggestions or anything like that, then please feel free to drop a comment. You can either reach me on mission_Bitcoin, which is my personal Twitter, or you can contact me at hardblockbtc. Until next time, thanks for listening.